Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's Ecologic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and today it's Doug Foy, the former president of the Conservation Law Foundation in Boston, Massachusetts. He then went on to take a position in the state government in Massachusetts under Governor Mitt Romney. He's been running a firm called Serafix for a number of years, consulting on environmental, energy, transportation, and climate issues. He serves on a number of board of directors, and he's been awarded with a number of awards of great accomplishment. So delighted to have Doug on the show today. Hey, Doug, welcome to the podcast. Great to see you.
Oh, it's nice to be here. Thanks, Ted, and thanks for inviting me.
Well, and where are you sitting right now as we speak? Are you in Boston?
I'm sitting in my office in Boston, downtown Boston, looking out at the Boston Harbor. It's outside my front window.
I've been to your place, and I remember the great view that you have there.
Yeah.
I can picture it. How great. So what are you up to today or this week? What's current?
Well, I got back to Boston the end of last week. I've been in Montana, where I have a place, and skiing and hanging out in the mountains. I came back. I've been sort of rebooting a bunch of things going on in the businesses. But this morning, actually, I did something wonderful. I just joined the board of a local organization, Community Rowing. I have a long history of rowing, and among other things. And there's this wonderful organization in Boston on the Charles River that is built around the premise of making rowing available to all the kids in the city of all stripes and sizes. And they had a erg contest today for the middle school kids in Boston. 1,200 kids racing on ergometers at the New Balance track, which is this huge facility in Boston. And it was, I'll tell you, the energy level, the vibrancy in this place was like, it just lit you up. And I spent a couple hours there just hanging out and helping. But it was, I mean, these kids were just totally cranked up. These are middle school kids, fifth grade, sixth grade, eighth grade. It was great fun, and it's something
How does that work? I mean, I thought they're rowing. What's the connection here? They're rowing, but there's some sort of a track that they're on?
No, they're on an ergometer. So they're the machines that are the classic sort of worldwide
rowing machine,
state-of-the-art rowing machines built by a company in Vermont, owned by a couple of brothers in Vermont, called the Concept 2 ergs and ergometers. And they're an elegant, incredibly sophisticated machine that has computer reads on it, so it can tell you exactly how you're doing. So everybody from Olympic quality athletes who train on these things to kids who have never been on them can row and can compete against each other. They had like 50 ergometers. So they had these schools racing against each other. And there's a huge message board literally tracking who's winning in these races based on the digital reads from these computers. So it's really quite the scene. There are world championships on indoor rowing now on these machines. Yeah. And it just so happened that it was in this huge athletic facility that New Balance is built in Boston that they make available to the community. So it was, but it was, that's what I did this morning. I suppose it has something to do with environmental stuff because it's on the Charles River ultimately, and that's part of the experience. But for me, just seeing these kids just lit on fire was really made you feel young again. That's for darn sure.
Yeah, I thought you were going to answer with some sort of erudite discussion of some environmental law proceeding.
But while
we're at it, because I didn't know this until I was doing a little bit of poking around in your resume this morning, but I didn't realize that you had been an Olympian. Rowing, were you in the eight in the Mexico Olympics in 1968?
No, I was on the team. I was actually an alternate in the four. We had a four without coxswain. And so it was Mexico. And we had made the team. Then we trained in Colorado, actually in the Black Canyon of the Gunnison at altitude. So we trained there and then Mexico City. And then I was on the national team the following year that went to Austria for European championships and whatever. So, and I had rowed in college. I had never rowed before I went to college, actually. I walked on to as something to do in the winter to stay in shape because I had been playing. I walked on to the football team And then my roommate decided after we played football in the fall that we should do something to stay in shape. And we went on to the rowing team, and you know, it became quite a passion. I still row.
Congratulations. I mean, those are huge accomplishments, you know.
Obviously. Yeah, it was fascinating. So it was a fascinating experience. And it was the first third world country, developing world country, to actually host the games. So it was a really big deal for Mexico. And
where did you grow up, Doug? Where was home for you?
I grew up in New Jersey, northern New Jersey, central New Jersey, and then northern New Jersey. And first by the ocean as a kid, and then my father moved to another job, and we moved up into central North Jersey, and in a beautiful little town with lakes and trails. And so I'd spent most of my youth, my brother and I, outside doing something outside.
Sports or something, right?
Sports or wandering through the woods or building, you know, snow forts or doing whatever, riding our bikes, hiking, yeah, whatever. So.
And then off you went to Princeton, which is, I guess, where you took up rowing. But
yeah.
I was interested, electrical engineering and physics?
Yeah.
You took the easy road? What?
Yeah, I took the light curriculum. And Princeton and the electrical engineering department was quite a good one. But the physics department is world class. I mean, it's sort of the among the finest physics programs anywhere, along with probably the Cavendish Labs in Cambridge and couple of MIT, Caltech, and so it was sort of irresistible. And I had a science gene that had always sort of motivated me. So yeah, so studied physics, loved it. Rode, played football, had a great time. Loved being at Princeton, and then ended up going to Cambridge on a fellowship. And but I was ultimately too argumentative to be a scientist. So I ended up applying to law school. I applied to one law school. I'm in Cambridge on a Churchill fellowship. And I applied to Harvard and figured, what the heck? I'm going to give it a shot. And I took the law boards and came back and went to law school.
And did you envision at that, how are you going to focus that law degree? Did you have a plan or a...
Well, you know, I think there was always this the wiring diagram in me to be focused on environmental issues. I grew up with my father was a huge gardener, so we spent a lot of time gardening and doing things out in the ground. And my maternal grandmother was a birder, and I still can identify. She started teaching me about birds when I was 4 years old. I have one of the original Roger Dorrit Peterson books. I can still recognize birds that I've never seen before. You know, I literally see a bird go by. Oh, I know what that bird is. And so I think that there was something that always drew me to the natural world, and physics was part of that, because it's the sort of ultimate science of describing why the world works the way it works. And then going to law school, I was pretty early on headed toward environmental stuff. I took the very first environmental law course that Harvard Law School ever offered, taught by Larry Tribe, who became a famous constitutional lawyer. But at the time, he was a young professor there, and he taught that course. And so that sort of had to be off in that direction.
I met you when you were the head of Conservation Law Foundation.
But right.
Were there stops before that after law school, or did you go directly to CLF?
No, I didn't. I went to a downtown law firm in Boston, a really good one, a very elite quality firm, small, Hill and Barlow, which produced a whole bunch of people that became the Patriots. The governors, Bill Weld was there. He became governor of Massachusetts. Mike Dukakis was there. He became governor of Massachusetts. There were people that just sort of sprung out of this firm and went into public service and public interest stuff. I was there for a couple of years, learned the tools of litigation and other things. And then I went, and I think I was the second paid employee at the Conservation Law Foundation. And the executive director, who was an unsalaried volunteer, a terrific guy. But and when he left, the board had to decide which of the two people there should run the place. Was it like a big? And so I ended up getting that job, and then we built COF into what it became.
And what did it become?
Well, it became, it's a passionately regional organization. It focuses on New England, the six New England states. And we did cases all over the country. I was involved in Alaskan oil drilling and other things because of things we did in New England that then became models for elsewhere in the country or the world. But we, the organization started out as a small, there were two of us, then three of us, then five of us, then 10, then 20, then 50, then 100. It started out as a law organization founded originally to do land conservation and to work with land trusts and stuff around New England. And when I took over as executive director, shortly after I took that job, the federal government announced that it was going to drill for oil on Georges Bank, the fishery in New England. And the organization had never litigated anything. There were literally were only three lawyers there. And we challenged that. The board was pretty nervous about that. And we were taking on the federal government, the Justice Department, the oil industry intervened, Covington and Burling was their lawyer. I mean, he's all these high flying law firms. We challenged it. We got the first injunction against offshore oil and gas drilling ever in the country. The folks at NRDC who had lost a bunch of those cases told us you can't win. They're going to crush it. We said, okay. And we won that case, went to the Supreme Court on an emergency appeal, where we won again. We won in district court, won in the Court of Appeals, won in the Supreme Court, and then stopped every successive lease sale after that. And Georges Bank was then removed from leasing 5-10 years later. And that started us down a path of using litigation as a tool. And it was in the early days of the heyday of environmental litigation. So we filed lawsuits on oil and gas, on fisheries management, cleaning up harbors, Boston Harbor, and a bunch of others, air pollution. We did probably 100 utility cases trying to force the utility industry to invest in energy efficiency, stop building coal-fired power plants. We did childhood lead poisoning cases to protect children from lead poisoning. We did transit cases to force transit investment rather than just building highways everywhere. So the organization became a multifaceted lawyers, scientists, economists. We prided ourselves on molding solutions rather than just stopping bad stuff. I mean, we felt obligated to actually craft an answer to things that were. So Boston Harbor, we spent a lot of time figuring out, helping the state figure out how to build the treatment works and how to get it done. And when they had we filed that case in 1983, and the goal was to clean the harbor up so the graduating high school class of the year 2000 could swim in its own water. Because these are kids that couldn't afford to go to Cape Cod to get to a beach. So if they couldn't swim here, they couldn't swim anywhere. And this Commonwealth at the time told us, no, that couldn't be done before 2020, 40 years later. And we said, no, that's ridiculous. And it was clean by the year 2000, and the kids can swim in that water now everywhere. You catch striped bass off the bridge in Charlestown, 4 foot long. So the organization was focused on a variety of environmental issues, ultimately in climate change as well, but very much committed to forging answers. So that's why we had a staff of economists, a staff of scientists, fisheries management people, lead poisoning experts, community organizers. And the organization is still thriving 50 years later. We had offices in all six New England states and by design focused on those states and then what the regional opportunities were.
Well, congratulations. And I hooked up with you with when the big dig was going on in Boston. The big dig was planned for Boston. And what was the story there? This was like an enormous tunnel that was going to go right underneath the downtown.
Well, the highway had been built in the 50s, classic 50s mentality, built a hideous, terrible elevated highway through the center of the city, rip out the neighborhoods and build the highway. So you had a 6 or 8 lane elevated structure. It cut the city of Boston off from its waterfront. The waterfront was, of course, polluted, heavily polluted harbor, one of the dirtiest in the country. So nobody wanted to be in the water anyway, but still there was no way to even get there. And the proposal was to bury the road, which in theory was a really good idea. And in fact, ultimately has proven to be a wonderful result for Boston. But it also was going to cost $15 billion. And the Commonwealth was going to pay a fair amount of that. So we went into it saying, well, we're in favor of tearing the road down. We think that's a really good idea. Why don't you just tear the damn road down and invest all this money in the transit system? And the Commonwealth said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to, we don't need the transit. You know, this road isn't going to fill up with cars. And we said, of course it's going to fill up with cars, and you're going to make air quality worse, even though you'll make visual quality much better. So we filed a lawsuit to force them. What they had said in their environmental impact statement was, the road won't fill up with cars and make air pollution worse because we're going to do all this other transit stuff, build the Green Line to Somerville and do all this stuff. And we went in and said, okay, your environmental impact says you're going to, the impact statement says you're going to do all this. We're going to file a lawsuit to make sure you do all that. And we're going to hold you to those promises. And that's what happened. And those became known as the CLF transit commitments. And it was $5 billion worth of transit investment. It extended the Green Line to Somerville, which is now open. I got on the Green Line yesterday, and it had Union Square as its destination, which is in Somerville, near, and then it goes to Tufts. It's hugely important transit investment, bunch of other things. And that was that lawsuit. We also, originally, the proposal was to, once they tore the road down, they were going to fill all that space up with new buildings. And we said, no. This is the perfect example to create, a perfect opportunity to create the connection to the water. We had already filed the lawsuit to clean up the harbor. So we're going to have a clean harbor. Let's have a park that connects the city to its waterfront. And that became the Greenway, the Rose Kennedy Greenway, which is, instead of having buildings in that where the road used to be, we have this beautiful linear park that runs all the way through the city. That was also part of the lawsuit. Oh,
that's fantastic. Amazing. Congratulations. What amazing accomplishments at CLF. And I'm glad that it's still going strong. 2003, Mitt Romney elected governor of Massachusetts. Right. And selects Foy to be his, what was the title of your?
I was secretary or chief of Commonwealth Development.
Commonwealth Development,
which is four agencies: housing, transportation, environment, and energy. And I didn't vote for Mitt Romney. I voted for the other person. I'm a Democrat or an independent in Massachusetts. Most of us are independents, but he got elected, and he came. His campaign staff had been coming to COF asking questions and wanting to understand things like climate change and transit and stuff. And then the stuff would pop up in the campaign. They actually were paying attention. And I thought, wow. And we were agnostic. We would talk to any political candidate that wanted to be talked to. And so I thought, wow, they're really thinking carefully about this. And then he, 2 days after he was elected, I had never met him. He and the guy who had run his campaign and then became Secretary of Administration and Finance called me up and said, we have an idea sort of based on the way you guys are structured, because we were a matrix organization. We had the way we covered issues and the way we had different skill sets applied to them. And they said, we think that the housing, transportation, environment agencies need to be much better coordinated to think about siting of housing, think about transit connections, walkability, think about the environmental impact of all this. And you guys have been doing all that in an integrated way. And we'd like to integrate that in state government. And so we want to combine those three agencies into one big effort. And we'd like you to head that agency. And if you don't agree to do it, we won't do it. And I said, oh, hell. I said, well, you need to add energy to that equation, but okay. And so that's got me into government. And it was quite a run, and then of course Mitt Romney went off to run for president and I went into the private sector. But in government, it's an incredibly intense experience. It's wonderful. You feel the pressure, the weight of the public purpose and the public civic obligations every day. You wake up, you live and breathe it every day. And, I think we got a lot of interesting stuff done. We wrote the first climate plan, I think, in the country, certainly for Massachusetts. We did all these. We pulled the final trigger on the lawsuits that I filed at COF to get the transit stuff built. We did a whole pile of stuff on integrating housing and school siting and walkability into the way Commonwealth money was spent. It was a wonderful experience. I recommend government to anyone who's had the chance, particularly later in their career when they can get into a fairly high level. Really something.
And what about REGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative? It sounds like you spearheaded that, or you were able, maybe this goes back to all your connections when you were at CLF. You're already working with all these states.
Right. Yeah, no, we did REGI. It was a combination effort amongst a bunch of states. Gina McCarthy, who then went on to go to EPA and then be climate czar for the president, Biden, she was we had a bunch of people in my agency who were babysitting the different agencies who were in the big agency. So, and Gina was in charge of the environmental agency to oversee it. And then I had secretaries in charge of each of those who reported to me. And then she went to Connecticut. So she was carrying the flag in Connecticut. Turns out that, that Brad Campbell was in New Jersey, who now heads CLF. And New York and Massachusetts. Those four states were the craftsmen of this. I was the spearhead in Massachusetts. And ultimately, Governor Romney didn't sign it because he wanted to run for president and he had to turn away from all that we had done on climate, even though he knew, and I know he knows, how important it all was. I mean, he embraced our climate plan. And ultimately, I knew the next governor would sign it. So yeah, REGI was a work of serious effort by all the states, but certainly those four were the pivotal players that got it done.
Fundamentally, this was an organization or an agreement amongst these states that they could allow carbon trading between them.
On a regional basis, and with California, the Northeast states and California are something like the third or fourth biggest economy in the world. We're talking about a really significant thing. And California was working on its own trading regime when we did REGI. The Europeans were fascinated with this because they thought everything had to go through Washington. And we were saying, no, Washington isn't going to get this anytime soon, but we're going to get it. And did. Yeah. So it trades carbon in the utility sector. There was an effort to actually extend it recently to the transportation sector, which has been stillborn at the moment, but I think will eventually happen. Mm-hmm. But it's been very effective, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars generated by the trading regimes have been invested in energy efficiency in the REGI states.
Right. Now, what does one do after one's been the chief of Commonwealth development?
Once one takes a deep breath. Actually, we went to mate and I, she and I went down to visit friends in Miami the day after I left government, and they had invited us down. So we go down there, and I remember getting up that morning. It must have been a Saturday morning. I left on a Friday. And I got up on a Saturday morning, and I picked up the Miami Herald paper and opened it up and realized I actually don't have to worry about anything that I'm going to read this paper today, because when you're in government, every day you pick up the paper and something happens that you didn't expect, or, and don't surprise me. And there were always surprises. And I remember the feeling of, that's sort of a relief. I don't have to worry about this right now. And then I went into the private sector. We set up a consulting business, and then we launched a series of companies. I'm a big believer that the three major players in climate change, you know this really well, you've been in it. The advocacy groups that have to be pounding on the door and demanding better performance. Government, which has an enormous role to play in cleaning up our act and dealing with the climate challenge. But ultimately, scale is going to happen in the private sector. We need companies to be embracing these targets, to be making a lot of money, pursuing the right things, doing good and doing well. So I ended up in the private sector helping a series of companies that are focused on climate change agendas. We launched a couple. I was on the board of several. And that's where I spend most of my time now. I'm on a bunch of nonprofits as well. But I'm a huge believer that private enterprise has got to fully engage to solve the climate crisis.
Right. And I noticed, I know you've been involved with Ameresco. You've been on the board for a number of years. Green Are You, my friend Rob Pratt's company. What is Rain Bank? I hadn't heard of it.
Rain Bank, well, that's still a startup phase, but it's working away. Rain Bank is a stormwater management company, urban stormwater management. And it works on the principle that if you can deal with the peak flows, you can save a lot of capital that otherwise has to be invested in pipes and treatment works. So the question of how to shave the peaks in a big storm event becomes an enormously interesting opportunity. And Rain Bank's principal goal is to use flat surfaces, whether they're roofs or parking lots or others, as places. If you put controls on the rain pipes coming off the flat roof, you can hold 2 inches of water in that roof and serve as a storage facility for an hour, 2 hours, until the system can catch up with the flows, and then you release the water. And that's the strategy under Rain Bank. Literally, storm surge storage.
That's fascinating. Accumetrics?
Accumetrics is it was a fuel cell company. It sold its fuel cell side. It is now a smart battery, ruggedized battery company. And of course, batteries become an increasingly important part of our future. So that's a very high-tech battery company. And the other company we started, Renew Energy Partners, is a energy efficiency finance company. So it raises private capital to invest in efficiency measures in other people's buildings.
So right now you're serving on, I'm guessing, 7 or 8 boards?
It seems that. Yeah, I was trying to retire and I'm doing a really crappy job.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I mean, I don't know, when I hear about your grandchildren, you're reading to your grandchildren, I hear about they're out in Concord, that's not far away. I hear about your place out in Montana. I hear about your place in Vermont.
Sugar Bush.
I'm not worried about Doug Foy. I usually ask my guests, how do they maintain balance? But it seems like you've got it covered here.
Well, I feel blessed. I've had incredible colleagues all my career, just like you. Wonderful people that I've been privileged to work with and for. The trajectory of my career has been, I didn't plan it that way, but it's starting out in an environmental advocacy group and in government and now in the private sector. If I had it to do over again, I'd probably do the same thing again. But part of me is still fascinated with the natural world and wants to be out in the natural world. So I spend a lot of time backpacking. I spend a lot of time skiing, hiking, taking my grandchildren out into those places, taking myself and my friends and family out into those places. And I still am happily trucking off for 6-day backpacks in the Beartooth Mountains in Montana. That's to be with that beautiful place.
Good stuff. Yeah. Thanks, Doug. So good to talk to you today.
Oh, it's great to talk to you, Ted. And take care. Thanks for having me on.
See you soon.
See you.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.